Welcome to another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies, or as I'm calling it, as I call it now every week, the Talking Pictures Podcast. We are joined this week, as always, by Bill Bregoli.
It's raining out.
And Bill McCuddy.
This show is a repeat.
I'm Neil Rosen. It is not a repeat. And joining us, returning to the podcast, who's also done the television show many times, our friend from Showbiz Cafe, Jack Rico. How you doing, Jack?
Thank you very much. Now it's Jack Rico from the Highly Relevant Podcast. I'm trying to move away from the showbizcafe.com.
Oh, all right. The Highly Relevant.
Wow.
Yes.
So
and you know why?
We actually compete with you?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
I just found out that hitting some crazy numbers on my podcast.
Well, why aren't we on your podcast instead of the other way around?
Well, because it's a U.S. Latino podcast.
Oh.
And as I'm watching through the room, there's no Latino.
No. We can cross over. I'm very big in the Latino community.
I'm going to get my DNA test back later. It will tell me. Maybe.
Yeah, your grandparents are from Chile, right? Yeah.
Bill McCuddy this week is going to talk about Detroit, the Catherine Bigelow show. You know Catherine Bigelow. She directed
Catherine Bigelow show.
TV show.
The Catherine Bigelow show that's on CBS.
Late night.
It's her big variety program. No pickups. Keep going.
Get it. We'll keep going. The movie Detroit, about the Detroit riots in 1967, directed by the Academy Award-winning film director Catherine Bigelow.
The soundtrack is playing right outside Bill's apartment.
Yeah. The siren you hear going by is from the movie.
We're broadcasting to you today from Bill McCuddy's apartment.
It's a nice apartment too.
We're also going to briefly touch upon, and I'm going to actually touch upon it right now, that there's two movies that are opening this week, Kidnap with Halle Berry and The Dark Tower. And there was an article, we taped the show on a Tuesday, there's an article in The Hollywood Reporter this week about how studios, now it's the end, we're in August now, and The Dark Tower is actually like the last big tentpole movie of the summer,
right,
according to them. And that Rotten Tomatoes, the website, is not, is... The studios are really fearing Rotten Tomatoes. The people, this is how, as opposed to listening to legitimate critics like ourselves, what they're doing is people...
Thank you for the upgrade.
They just go on Rotten Tomatoes, and if they have that splat on there as opposed to the tomato, and they see that it's 28%, they're saying, I don't want to see that. And that is becoming the base of film criticism, likely, in terms of what people are turning to. So they're not screening these movies for us until a day before they open.
And before we get to your point in this piece, we should remind people that we have talked ad nauseum in the past about how Rotten Tomatoes seems to pluck what they want out of somebody's review to make it either positive or a negative review. And there are people who complain about the fact that...
How do you know about this? Before you continue, because I had never heard about that. Is that some sort of corrupt system?
Jack.
Oh, yeah. Well, not corrupt, but edited, highly edited in terms of what they want to
present. Or artificially
curated. Lisa Rossman, who does this podcast, who will be back in 2 weeks, by the way, and Jack and the film critic for Newsday, our friend Rafer Guzman, who does Talking Pictures, the TV show when it existed, which we are still trying to get back on the air.
Rest in peace.
And is a good friend of ours. They were both talking once about the fact that Rafer in particular was saying he hated this movie, but they gave it a tomato, not a splat, a positive thing, and they pulled some, if you just, instead of, they pull a line or two, and he goes, I dislike this movie, I don't understand where they're getting this
Owen,
from.
Chris from Entertainment.
Chris Najawadi made the same point
from Entertainment Weekly,
well.
Yeah. So you haven't heard that it's a little bit adjusted?
No. Well, it sounds a lot like the Radio Payola, where a movie studio could have major influence upon a film. For example, I think we all know that Rotten Tomatoes is owned by Warner Brothers.
Yes, and also Universal, I also think, has a slight stake in it, too.
Right, so sort of like Hulu, where everybody...
Comcast,
right.
Universal. Yeah.
So obviously there's a conflict of interest there, legally. I'm not sure that I've seen Warner Brothers films highlighted in Rotten Tomatoes more than others. I think that would make it probably too specific and obvious. But I have not heard that Rotten Tomatoes on the down low is somewhat highlighting or featuring movies. And you have to probably question where that is coming from. Are they getting paid?
What
are they getting in return for those features?
I haven't heard anything along the lines that Rotten Tomatoes is a rigged game. I mean, I pretty much... Again, I don't know, but I pretty
well, what
much,
we're describing
I
is a little rigged. What you want to talk
rigged,
about
yeah.
right now, the fact that they're not showing certain critics things until very close to the screening.
All right, so if you see an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
Do you trust that? Do you trust that, Bill Bregoli?
Not knowing some of the people who write for Rotten Tomatoes, no.
And, I mean, you know, we're talking...
80% is a pretty good number.
Here's the thing. Yeah.
There's also Metacritic. I don't know if you guys follow Metacritic.
Yeah. What I was in the article in the Hollywood Reporter today, too, is that it's just not... It's the same thing, but it's just not, you know, it just doesn't get the same hits and views as Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes seems to be like...
It's the king.
Like, it's like Google. People go to Google to search for something as opposed to going to Yahoo to search for something.
Right.
Bing.
Or Bing.
Right. I mean, it's Rotten Tomatoes is the brand. And listen, when I worked for New York One for all those years, which was before it was owned by Charter Spectrum, it was owned by Time Warner Cable, and before Time Warner Cable, it was part of Time Warner Inc. They split into separate companies. And I remember that the guy who
this ran, portion of the podcast is in black and white.
I remember that the guy from Time Warner Cable, when I first started there, Time Warner said, "By the way, I want you to know if you're ever thinking of blasting a Warner Brothers movie, go for it. You know, like don't think because you work for Agar. Well, I would never think that I would give it a good review." He goes, "Well, good." He goes, "Because I don't care."
I'll throw Fox News a bone and say that I was told never to worry about whether it was a Fox film or not. Little publicists from Fox who worked literally two floors away from me would come down and go, "Bill, didn't you love Daredevil? And didn't you love?" And I'd be like, "You'll see when I talk about it this weekend."
Well, before we get to, and I want to get to Detroit very shortly, but I got to tell you, we all review films, and how many of us have gotten the phone call where it's like, "I'm looking for a quote for this movie."
Yeah.
Would you be comfortable saying, "Holly Hunter was really, you know, funny and dramatic in this role?" I go, "No, I wouldn't be comfortable having you tell me to say anything in this thing. Can you give us a quote about Holly Hunter?" No, not really. You could read my review, you know, but there are advanced quotes. If I do really like something, I would call up and say, "Hey, I thought this was a great movie."
I think I've told this story, but the best one that I ever did was for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which I really, really liked, the Coen Brothers film.
George
and
Clooney.
I called it a Clooney Tunes laugh fest. I had this long quote that had two or three puns in it that they called and said, "This is a great quote. We really, really want to use something that you say. How about just the word hilarious?" I didn't have hilarious anywhere in my long quote.
So
and I said, "No, thank you." Well, it turns out when you open the Sunday New York Times, and we used to see our names in ads all the time. It's not as frequent now. I don't give quotes anymore. But the point is, there was a huge, like, 48-point banner headline that said hilarious, and then it had like 40 critics under it.
Oh.
So they talked 40 other people into saying that, but not Bill McCuddy. And here I am today doing a podcast in my own apartment.
Your name in the New York Times, and people call you and go,
"Yeah,
just
no,
saw your
cool
name in the New York Times. You want to be invited to this thing, VIP treatment for
yeah,
this?"
Not so much, but it was cool to have a double truck headline one time for The Kingdom, which said the best movie of the year so far by far, and that was the biggest headline I've ever seen across double truck is two full pages, and my family was actually sort of impressed by that one.
I was seeing, I was watching NBC's Sunday Night Football, and a commercial came in.
Oh.
And it was my quote. And I was like, "Holy smokes." It was
I was on the Super Bowl. I mean,
did you have to pause it, though, to see your name really fast?
I paused it because it's always in fine print.
I was working for a radio station that no longer exists called WNCN, which is a classical music station in New York. And let me tell you, the day after the Super Bowl, and who wasn't watching the Super Bowl? And this wasn't like the way it's in microtype right now, two-point type, and for a second.
Yeah.
They had my quote up there with my name. It was a good, like, three seconds on the screen. And the next day, I walked into that station, and the general manager and the program, like, they couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like they couldn't buy something like that,
right,
you know?
Right, right, right.
So that, as far as quotes go, the first time I ever got quoted in an ad, which was maybe 30 years ago, it was a movie called Street Smart. It was the movie that brought Morgan Freeman. It was Christopher Reeve. It brought Morgan Freeman to attention. He played a pimp. Nobody knew who Morgan Freeman was. And I gave a quote, and you know, I got the arts and leisure section of the Sunday Times, and I opened it up, and I saw my name like there. It was the first time I ever saw my name in the paper.
And Morgan called him and said, "Neil, thank you so much for putting
it." It was very, very exciting.
Movie.
And then once on a
credit.
Broadway show, it was Lost in Yonkers. I had this entire, if you walk by the theater, this entire wooden plaque that took up like half the size of where it said Lost in Yonkers. You know, it said Neil Rosen, you know, the great Neil Simon player. And that was exciting. But then,
and that placard is now in his apartment.
Is it? Yes.
No, it's not.
He sold it on eBay.
But the point is, so it was exciting in the beginning, but then it got to the point where I just didn't give a shit anymore.
Now you just get slammed by your friends on Facebook.
I didn't care anymore.
Yeah. That's if he's on Facebook.
And then I went from not caring anymore to actually not wanting to be quoted because I didn't like, most of the attention I don't like. And I just didn't want to appear in an ad. Like, in other words, if I liked... We'll just use Holly Hunter. I don't know why I'm picking on Holly Hunter today, but let's just say I did like Holly Hunter's performance in the movie, but hated the movie. They said, "Well, can you say that like Holly Hunter? You know, can you
right? It's manipulation.
It would look like I was endorsing the movie, and you know, so
it hurts
I got
your
to
reputation.
The point where I didn't, unless it was a movie that I truly loved, you know." Like Brooklyn or something like that. Where
well, I shut them down by just giving them funny quotes that I knew they'd never use. Like, what was the one with Kurt Russell and Kathleen Quinlan where they their kid gets hijacked, their car, and they're in the middle of the desert?
Breakaway?
Yeah, Breakdown, I think. Yeah, I said Kathleen
That's
Quinlan.
I like that.
They put Kathleen Quinlan in a bag, and they're like, they've got her in the back of this truck, and I said, Kathleen Quinlan looks great in the sack. And they're like, no, we're not using that. Billy's been quoted too, but you know, it's all about context, I think.
Yeah.
It's all about whether they have the context correct or incorrect. I'll give you one quick example, and then I want to hear some of Bill's quotes. Fox News took out a full-page ad this week in the New York Times that said Fox and Friends, quote, is the most powerful network morning television
it's
show.
The Hollywood Reporter quote. Yeah,
that's no, it was a New York Times quote.
Oh, okay.
New York Times at some point in some place said
Hollywood
it was
Reporter because the Hollywood Reporter had done a profile on them.
And what
first.
What I found hilarious about that was the New York Times didn't mean that as a compliment. They meant it as a warning. And only Fox News would take that quote and buy
context,
an ad in the New York Times
context,
quoting it.
Context,
so it's
context.
It's just about how they can take things out of context.
Absolutely.
Good quote of yours, Bill.
Oh yeah, the first Charlie's Angels movie. When that first
what
came
did
out,
you say?
I said it's The Matrix meets Austin Powers meets Three Beautiful Girls.
Nice.
And Sony put that on a double truck headline. And
what does double truck
double
mean?
Double truck means two pages,
two full pages,
side
one
side.
Ad across
oh,
two.
But you know, print is going
a full spread
right now. Quotes are first of all so much. If you look in any newspaper, the movie section with the full-page movie ads with the quotes has diminished dramatically. You don't see that anymore, that much anymore. Would you agree?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Right. And
which is why when you see them on television, you have to pause to
right.
see
yeah.
somebody,
see
to
television.
See Mark S. Allen's name.
When you see them on television, the you know, you see the word, like, to use your word, hilarious, in huge type, and then the critic is, you can't even barely read it, and if you do pause it and look at it, it's some website thing, you know, some web critic that you never
right.
heard of. And those numbers on Rotten Tomatoes, just before we move on from this, those numbers on Rotten Tomatoes are all critics. I only look at the top critics, which are the legitimate critics, but the number is averaged in from
the
everybody.
Raw aggregate number you're saying is everybody. Oh, and speaking of New York One, we're
New
just...
York One on TV.
I won't stop. I'll tell you one more quote story. When my father passed away last February, we went to clean up his stuff out of his room. And we opened the drawer, and it was full of newspaper clippings of my quotes.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So he liked me
being
quoted.
So it meant something to him.
So I got quoted, so my dad could...
All right, before we move on to Detroit, what's your favorite quote that you ever got quoted? Like something punny and fun that they picked up?
Oh, God, there were a ton of them. I really am not trying to brag. I was in
hilarious.
A bunch.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it wasn't hilarious.
Hilarious.
It was, no.
Looney Tunes.
I can't even tell you. I mean,
all right, mine was from a movie called and Reader's Digest. Do they still publish Reader's Digest?
Is yeah, that? They do.
Okay, so the quote was so funny to them that Reader's Digest actually printed this in my quote from the movie. The movie was Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase, and I said Memoirs of an Invisible Man is a must see. And they
wow.
thought that was funny, and they put it in Reader's
Let me go
Digest.
Get some ice for my ribs, because that's I lost weight. It was too funny.
Yeah, and again, this was back when I was working for that classical radio station. the guy, that one of the guys that was working there, thought that I didn't realize what I was saying. He goes, he thought it was like, I didn't realize that. Yeah, I didn't realize that. That was just total, you know.
Was that Elliot?
No, Elliot's good. He'll remain nameless. He was somebody in the programming department. All right, so Bill McCuddy saw Detroit, the Catherine Bigelow film, which, again, looks at the Detroit riots in 1967. The whole country was exploding in 1967. Many cities. Newark burned, and, you know, the Bronx burned, and lots of stuff.
Watts,
like that.
Chicago, yeah. So
Bill McCuddy, take it away and tell us about Detroit.
Well, I'm going to tell you that basically it's a very claustrophobic, it takes place in the Algiers Motel, which was this sort of ramshackled motel in Detroit that was very close to a place that the Michigan State Police and the National Guard were brought into police after about 5 days of rioting and the inability of the local cops, who were extremely racist, to get control of the situation. There is an unfortunate thing that happens at this motel that sets off a series of events that has a racist cop and a couple of other people rounding up everyone in this one motel annex room, putting them in a hall, and either one by one executing them or not executing them, in a long, drawn-out evening of extreme prejudice and extreme heat. The claustrophobic aspect and putting us in 1967 Detroit is amazing. However, there are some elements to this now, and we talked about Rotten Tomatoes a second ago, something like 95% approval rate for this film, that I can't get behind. And one of them is, at the very end of the film, it's explained that there is no real record of what happened in this motel. So this film is pieced together from different interviews and accounts, which have to be weighted by a lot of years that have passed, and B, people telling one version or another version of the story. I absolutely believe there was a racist incident that happened there. But there's one thing that everyone who's, without giving too much away, everyone who's being interrogated knows what really happened, and nobody says anything. And that, to me, I found almost impossible to believe. So that took me out of the film for a bit. And there's also a sub-story about a real group called the Dramatics, who came out of Motown, one of whom was in the motel when this happened. And
you never heard about the Dramatics, though. I mean,
they became a big group after this incident, but the guy, one of the guys who's in the Dramatics, decides not to be part of the group. He's very affected by this. It's very well done. However, it is one-sided, slamming you over the head with, there's no good side to this. There's no other side of the story to tell, but it's extremely difficult to watch, and there are moments that I find completely unbelievable, and so for that reason I was
unbelievable
disappointed
in what sense?
Well, as I said, I don't
because
want to give too much of
accounts,
the
you mean?
The different accounts may
give me an
contribute
example, something
to,
that you found without being a spoiler.
Well, I said these people are being interrogated all night. They believe that they are being one by one executed. They know what really happened without giving away too much of the storyline, and nobody confesses or nobody says, hey, let us go, this is what happened. I found that very difficult to believe. And then at the very end, when it said, we don't really know, because there was a trial. I won't tell you how that ends. They show the trial very efficiently. There's some big names in the movie at the very end, which is kind of weird. And it runs a little long. That all said, I did go to Detroit for 2 hours. I was in 1967, so it does a very good job of placing you in that time and place. But once you're there, I don't believe everything that I'm seeing on the screen.
So two questions from Detroit. Number one, what did you think about John Boyega? Do you think he's A-list material now after this movie? Do you think that the film will get some Oscar buzz? And number two, Catherine Bigelow, where do you see her now with this film moving forward?
On
is
the
she
Oscar
the
buzz,
real deal or not?
On the Oscar buzz, there's no question that Catherine Bigelow is the real deal from what she's done before this. This may just be considered a misstep.
So you consider the movie a misstep?
A little
her?
Bit, yeah.
Wow,
I mean,
okay.
It's not. It doesn't.
I can tell you right now, I can tell you, I doubt there's going to be a lot of Oscar nominations.
Well, they've been talking about it. But let's look at, again, I repeat, 95% of the critics like it. It's important. It deals with something that really happened. It has all of the Oscar-y kind of things about it.
And why are they dumping it in August?
Well, I don't know that they're dumping it. It's counter-programming to a lot of big tentpole stuff.
But the Oscar stuff, if they really, the studio really felt it was an Oscar contender,
then they'll re-release it.
Wouldn't they put it out?
They'll re-release it.
November or something like that?
They'll put it on DVD for people to watch. Don't worry, the voters. And
yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't know if it has the legs to get to...
Well, you never know, because maybe November, October, September, whatever it may be, maybe it's packed. And you don't want to be putting this movie in a place where you have so many Oscar competitors where your film probably won't be seen. This one probably gives them the best shot of being talked about more than any other time. I mean, it's closer to the fall than it is, like, this isn't January either, you know?
I'm going to have Jack talk about a movie, but before we do, I want to tell you that Robert Wall, comedian, star of Arliss, who's done this show numerous times, sent Bill McCuddy and I a very funny 8.5-minute clip, which I want to highly recommend to you, that you can find on YouTube. And all you have to type in is Tiffany, I think it's pronounced Haddish, H-A-D-D-I-S-H, and Jimmy Kimmel.
Right.
And Robert Wall sends us this thing, and he says, this is just really funny. Check it out.
We talked about the movie Girls Trip with Lisa Rossman last week. She enjoyed it. I couldn't understand why, but we all agreed this girl is very, very funny.
So she is the less known star in the film. I mean, we've got Jada Pinkett Smith in the movie, and you've got Queen Latifah, and you've got all these high profile, and you know, Tiffany Haddish is not exactly a household name here. But you watch this 8-minute clip where she tells a story about when they were filming this movie. And
by the way, something that hardly ever happens in late night anymore. He gives her 8 minutes to tell one story.
He doesn't even interrupt her. And she,
Kimmel is rolling with it 100%.
She's a monologist. I mean, she's doing this hysterical story about she had this Groupon to get a swamp tour down in New Orleans, where they
made the film.
Where they could look at the crocodiles.
Well, Kimmel sets it up by going, gee, when you make a movie with Jada Pinkett Smith, does Will Smith ever drop by? And she says, did he drop by? And then this launches this great story.
Right, and it's a story about them going on a swamp trip with two of the biggest, certainly one of the biggest movie stars in the world, and you know, and she doesn't mince words. I mean, she talks about these people knowing that they're movie stars and mingling with regular people on a swap trip on a Groupon. And it is funny. And
one of the things you're going to wonder.
This woman is going to be.
Yeah, she's a breakout star. I thought so. I thought so in the movie.
But she's going to get a talk show.
Yeah, maybe. One of the things that's the most interesting about it that I think will make more people watch it, besides you recommending it, and me too, is that you really wonder at the end of it whether or not Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith really wanted her to tell this story. It flatters them in some places, and it doesn't flatter them in other places.
Oh, it doesn't flatter them in a lot of places.
Well, it's not horrible, but it's really, really... dicey in a couple of spots, and that's fun. That's fun. It's
I'm not
never
giving you a $20 rent a car without tinted windows. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like
yeah, it's funny.
A little above the
it's
fray
very
here.
Funny.
All right, so I recommend that. Now, Jack saw The Villainess.
Yeah.
Well, I brought this up a couple of weeks ago because I'd seen a long lead screening of it, and I asked.
So you both saw it.
I saw it too.
I bumped into Bill at the screening yesterday.
So yeah. Jack, tell us about The Villainess.
Listen, this was on the suggestion of Bill McCuddy. Thank you very much.
I gave
that
a little plug 2 weeks ago. I said it was like La Femme Nikita in Korea. And
so this is a movie that is from South Korea. It's an action drama romance. It's almost like undefinable. But the opening scene has got to be one of the greatest opening scenes in film history. It felt like a video game. It's seen from the point of view of the
POV.
Person. It's the POV, right?
Right.
So I'll just mention really quickly the opening scene. It's a woman who walks into a, looks like a hallway reminiscent of Old Boy, and kills everybody. It's one of the most violent films I've seen, too, in the process. And just when you think everything is over and all the blood's been spattered, a second action
she goes
like,
in another
sequence
room.
Happens again, and the movie hasn't even truly started to kind of tell you what it is. Once you're fully exhausted with this and the amount of blood that's been going on and the fighting and everything, and you realize it's a woman, it starts kind of, the movie kind of starts beginning, and then there's a sword fight that happens throughout the middle of the film on motorcycles. At this point, I'm just going, I don't think I've ever seen these types of stunts in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's what I said a couple weeks ago.
She's been a trained assassin since she's been like a little kid.
Yes, or something. Yes, yes.
Is there a backstory as to why she's been trained?
There's a revenge element.
Yeah,
there's a revenge element to this.
It's very much Kill Bill, and
there's
Billy
elements
saw it
of
last
Kill Bill
too.
And I was telling Bill before we started that I think many parts. I don't know how the film's going to do here successfully. It's in Korean. People are going to have to watch subtitles. But I think
American remake.
Directors are going to be stealing parts of this film.
Some very original action sequences in it. Just when you think you've seen everything. Was it the Korean one that where they went into a building and they had to go floor by floor?
That's an Indonesian film.
The Raid?
Yes.
The Raid.
The Raid.
Yes.
And then the
yes.
Raid 2, yes. They did it again.
Well, yes. Dredd. There was Judge Dredd.
Movie.
And it wasn't like a remake. It was actually somebody had kind of thought of the same premise at the same exact time.
The original with Stallone?
We're talking about there was a remake of Judge Dredd that redid it, but it felt just like The Raid.
Well, Hardcore Harry had
Hardcore Henry.
It was all from the perspective of the fighter, and you never
POV,
got to see him.
Right.
That's how this movie starts, and it really, really, really sucks
you. Oh, and the ending is a one-take scene.
They jump around in time so that the thing you've seen at the beginning of the movie may not necessarily be what has happened in the very beginning of her story.
Bill Brigoli, did you like the film?
I liked it. I wish, frankly, it had a little more sex in it. is that you talking to Bill Brigoli here? It's just a little more than just heads being. After a while, I was a little numbed by the violence.
It needed some atomic blonde lesbian scenes, definitely.
Okay. what I did not like about the film was probably the plot line itself.
I'll let you say that, but sure. I will say you have to admit that it had one. It had a lot of story.
There's
a lot going on in there.
The problem with the villainess is two things. A, you go into it, and the tone that it sets is that it's in a bloody, violent action film. That's the tone going into it. And then about 30 minutes in, the next hour or so is really developing all these characters, and it becomes a dramatic, romantic genre.
An epic almost.
A little goofy almost at times. The acting wasn't necessarily great. The draw here are the action scenes. It's those three scenes.
No
the
question.
Opening scene, the sword fighting scene in the middle, and the last one-take scene that takes about 20 minutes on a bus. Imagine Speed, but even better, right? In just
but
one
you had
last
problem
scene.
With the, you weren't sucked into the story.
I wasn't sucked
you
into the story because I felt Old Boy had a better plot twist.
I had the opposite reaction, which was I admired the fact that finally I'm seeing an action movie with an intelligent or goofy at some points, sure. Mm-hmm. But almost an epic story in the middle of all this that helped me care much more about
they
her.
They did care about storyline. I just wasn't as captivated the way I was with the action stunts in this film.
By the way, you'll never move into another apartment without really checking out your neighbor first.
Well, fantastic film
since
overall.
Since they trained
though.
This girl since she was a little kid, there's a movie and I recommend this movie highly. It's called Hannah. With Saoirse Ronan, the star of Brooklyn, where she was also trained by her father.
Which played Eric Bana?
Eric Bana.
To be a, like a killing machine, and she was almost robotic. I mean, my name is Hannah. I was raised in Germany. I like milk duds.
My favorite scene is where she has a first kiss with a little boy and she almost slugs him.
Yeah. So there's a.
That was my honeymoon.
And then who is the villainess that she comes at? There's a famous actress that she.
Kate Blanchett.
So there's a movie that had great action, and I was sucked into the story.
That was a great movie. That was a great movie.
And I do highly recommend Hannah if you could find it on Netflix, on demand, Amazon, something like that. But. You're saying the story was not as involving.
This is the most innovative film. Right. This is the most innovative action film you'll see in modern times.
It's also not very sentimental.
No.
If you think about little kids and you think, oh, well, don't worry, the kid's going to make it through this scene.
Right. This is this spoiler is, this alert. Is the type of spoiler film alert. That's going to be really, really sort of a major appeal with the urban community that loves all that violent video game stuff with millennials and Generation Z fans. This is a movie that I believe is going to get a lot of legs heading into sort of that cult status amongst people that really don't know about it because it's South Korean. But I know that this is going to happen. There's going to be a remake, and they're going to have, and I think the perfect person to do the remake is Michelle Rodriguez.
I would say that or Amy Schumer. Yeah.
Or Amy, Amy Schumer. No, that's the last person that would do this movie. But I think a Michelle Rodriguez would be perfect for the American remake of this film.
Yeah. So as the Hollywood Reporter said, Dark Tower is the last big tentpole movie of the summer. Since
opening this weekend, along with
Kidnapped, the Halle Berry film. Now, here's my question to all of you.
Well, let's set it up for your question. We haven't seen either of these movies
because right. Well,
they haven't really been showing them.
Well, let me say a little bit about it. It's based on a series of books from Stephen King, and it's the classic tale of good and evil, and it's about a dark tower that's...
Holds the universe together.
Uh-huh. And the project's been in the works for about a decade, but a lot of critics and a lot of fans consider this to be the masterpiece story of Stephen King because it puts all of the books and every single story that Stephen King has done under one hub. And that's where the specialness of The Dark Tower is. Now, the cinematic adaptation, that has gotten a lot of mixed reviews, and it's been sort of almost chaotic.
And we haven't really had a chance to see it. I mean, you're getting to go tonight, but I mean, this is always another harbinger of trouble,
This goes to what I said at the top of the podcast, was that because of Rotten Tomatoes, and we get into August, where it's not really the primo stuff, they are really just not, they don't really want the critics to do it until the day before. You know, they want to get that opening weekend. But the question that I was going to pose was, since it's all about opening weekends, really, and it's about maybe you bleed into the second or third weekend, why won't they open up a tentpole movie in the middle of August or on Labor Day when a lot of people, you know... Let's go to the movies. I mean, why? That's my question. Why?
Because Labor Day is, let's get our kid back into school.
Yeah, let's pack up the house. Let's move. They got other stuff. That's the last barbecue weekend. I mean, there hasn't been a big opening in late August or early September almost 10 years. That's not a new thing because of Rotten Tomatoes is all I'm saying.
It's pack up let's pack up the house.
I guess. I mean, not that everybody has a vacation house.
Well, you know, in the South... Which, you know, growing up in New York, it's shocking to me, and I don't understand it. They go back to school in like mid to early August, and you know, which makes no sense because if you've ever been down in the South, which I've been, it's so hot down there. This is, you know, I don't know why that is, but schools start in the middle of August.
It's hot down there because it's the South.
Right, but I'm saying, why would you want to? I mean, this started before the advent of air conditioning. Why would you want to start school? Is it something to do with farming?
Were you just in the South the one time, Neil?
No, I've been in the South. Okay. I've been in Tennessee.
Don't let that burning bagel on the lawn
send you back up
north.
I've been in Florida in August.
They welcome you.
It is
Disney
really
World
hot
doesn't
down
count.
There. We you would have... figure, if anything, they'd start later in the South, but okay. All right, so let's talk about the passing of two people this week. Sam Shepard. Now, Sam Shepard, here's a guy that, you know, did not grow up in New York, but, you know, spent really his formative years of his career in New York City. He was working at the Village Gate, which was an old thing down on, you know, Bleecker Street.
Uh-huh.
And very prolific. I mean, you know, not only an actor, and he was nominated for an Academy Award and did a great job in one of my all-time favorite movies, another recommendation this week, The Right Stuff. Which is really, to me, one of the great... Philip Kaufman directed this movie, and it's really one of the great movies about the early days of the space program, the Mercury astronauts. And so many people came out of that movie that you didn't really know before the movie.
He was also in August Osage County recently. He worked a lot.
Oh, he was in the opening scene. He was the father who dies of Alzheimer's or something.
Yeah,
he's been in a ton of stuff. He was in that. He was in the Mud with.
Matthew McConaughey.
He was in Mud with Matthew McConaughey.
Mud.
And
Mud.
He's been in it, but you know, he played Chuck Yeager in the right stuff, and the guy that had the
he always told the truth in a movie. I used to say that about Sidney Lumet, the late Sidney Lumet. Whenever he was an actor in a movie, whether he spoke in a, like Michael Clayton, what do you mean gonna do it? They're doing it now. He always had the lines that were the truth in the script, and Shepard was the same way. If Sam Shepard said it in a movie, it was probably a true statement as opposed to other people who might be lying in the movie.
Right, Neil, I know you're going to get to this in a second, but we got to remember that Sam Shepard also is a great playwright.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Pulitzer winner, was nominated for another two Pulitzers at one point.
He was a great
writer.
One
for True West, and I can't remember the other one.
He wrote...
But Buried Child was the one that recently was here in New York. I had a chance to see it. Ed Harris was the star of that.
Oh, yeah,
and,
right.
His wife was also one of the leads, and it's a very heavy film about the loss of a child and these parents and how they cope with it. As soon as you walk into the theater, Ed Harris is already there 20 minutes before, just already acting. And it was something that I had not seen before.
Oh, like
before.
A preamble? Like a thing
preamble.
Where...
I had never seen before. So I thought that was really experimental and cool. And a lot of what he did was
he
in
supposed
San Francisco
to do that,
at the Magic
just...
Theater. I'm not sure if you heard about the Magic Theater in San Francisco, which was where all the A-list actors used to go to an experiment on new stuff, kind of like the way comedians do when they want to test new material out. So there's also a new documentary called California Typewriter, which is an ode to typewriters. And a lot of the people and playwrights and screenwriters... It comes out August 14th, maybe
August.
Yeah, I've
got a link to that. I haven't watched it.
Take a look at it if you want to see one of the last appearances of Sam Shepard on screen.
Oh, cool.
It's a documentary
about typewriters and all these people that still... No, because it comes out soon. I'm seeing a screening next week.
Woody Allen still apparently writes all his movies on a manual Remington typewriter.
Do you know there's a software package that'll make your computer sound like the... Yeah, that's very popular.
What is it? What's the app?
I should look it up. I'll put it on the next
great.
Mention
that's
next week. It's funny.
But
a funny story about True West is that it was playing here, I'm going to say like in 2007 or 8, and it starred John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That's right.
And I was in the Palm restaurant across the street when Philip Seymour Hoffman went to, no, on this, on the west side.
Oh, the one on 50.
Yeah, because it was playing at the Gershwin, I think. And, or the Circle in the Square. Anyway,
the Circle in the Square.
Yeah, so Philip Seymour Hoffman walks in. I'm like, hey, and we're not at the urinals, but I'm like, and he recognized me from the junkets and stuff. And I said, it was like 20 to 8. It was like 7:30 or something, curtain in like half an hour. And I said, you got to get over to the theater. He goes, I'm all ready. And he was in character. And I said, what are you doing? Because it's a two-man show, Philip Seymour Hoffman and John C. Reilly. And they were famous for playing both parts. And so I thought they alternated every night. And I said, who are you tonight? He goes, I won't know till I get there. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, we flip a coin right before we go on.
Hilarious.
And that's how we decide
that's
who
great.
Plays what. That's magic.
That's really cool. When you're at the height and the pinnacle of your craft.
Because Laura Linney is doing The Little Foxes right now.
That's set. She knows what night
with,
she's doing.
Who's the other one that's in that? But they trade the part every night. But they're doing that on purpose so that people will go see it twice.
Well, I remember. I was watching something in Astor Place. What's the theater in Astor Place near Joe's Pub? Shakespeare, I think. Not a Shakespeare in the Park. The one that's in Astor Place is a theater there.
The Public Theater.
So the Public Theater. John Krasinski is literally walking in 10 minutes. I walked in with him. And he was like in a black sweater, and I'm going, he's the star of the play. What is he just doing walking in? And I think these guys have it so memorized and so well, they're so intimate with their roles that they don't need any rehearsal time. They just go in 5 minutes before and just bang it out.
When The Odd Couple ran for many years on Broadway as a play before it was a movie with Walter Matthau as Oscar.
God damn it.
Mark Carney actually played Felix. Matthau was lobbying for a couple of performances to switch roles. He wanted to do Felix and have Art Carney. And you could see Art Carney playing Ed Norton on The Honeymooners, if you know that show, actually being slobby.
That's fun to see them do
and
that.
And they wouldn't let him do it. They were like, if you want to act, act somewhere else. You're going to be Oscar, and that's it. But if you see, and Bill McCuddy and I talk about this all the time, a great movie, another great recommendation, A New Leaf, which was written and directed by Elaine May.
Carbon on the Valves.
Right. You could see you could see Walter Matthau playing the Felix Unger kind of character because he is this kind of like uptight kind of, you know, you
can, well, I'm sure that was one of the things that attracted him to the
yeah, but I mean, if you watch film, that, I mean, he wanted to do against kind of a type. Felix-esque kind of thing, you know, so
Morgan Freeman, to come full circle, told me the worst thing a screenwriter can say is, I wrote this with you in mind, because he finds it an insult. Now, Morgan Freeman has played the same guy in a lot of movies. But his point was, if you want to flatter me as an actor, don't tell me you've written something
for
based
me.
On what I've done before. Show me something I haven't done.
My recommendation is, it's like critics' picks from the old TV show Talking Pictures, is A New Leaf, and it is literally about a millionaire playboy played by Walter Matthau, who loses all his money, and he says, I have three choices here. I can get a job. Well, I'm not going to do that. I could commit suicide. There's an idea. Or I can marry somebody rich. And he decides to marry somebody rich, and he finds this woman who's, I guess, nerdy would be the
yeah. Thing.
She's a botanist who played by Elaine May, who
she wrote the script too.
Right, and he studies up all on plants and botany. And all different types of species of leaves to impress her, and it's hysterically funny. To use the word hysterical, that is hysterical. I think you'd agree with me on that.
I agree completely.
Jean Moreau, before we go, died, the famous French actress. You know, she also, she was in the original Jules and Jim.
François Truffaut film.
Yeah, a landmark film and linked to a lot of William Friedkin.
William Friedkin, she was married to, but I guess she was kind of shtupping a lot of guys.
God love her. But she
was married
she
to
was
Will?
Also,
well, I don't know.
She was extremely prolific, and in addition to making a lot of French films and being a tremendous actress, yeah, so she's been in a lot of films, and, you know, American audiences aren't that familiar with her. I mean, she did 7 Days, 7 Nights, and she got the BAFTA Award for Best Foreign Actress for a movie called Viva Maria, and the Caesar Award, which is like kind of like the French equivalent of the Oscar, for Best Actress in a movie called The Old Lady Who Walked in the Sea, and that was in, like, the early 90s.
I'll be the first to admit, even as a critic, I'd never seen much of her work and didn't know, but there are people this week mourning her big time because I guess she was part of that French New Wave at one point.
Yeah, well, Jules and Jim is really like an iconic movie. And also, she was a singer. Like we talked about, Sam Shepard, not, you know, you might know him as an actor, but he was also a playwright. He did a lot of stuff. You know, she even performed at Carnegie Hall with Frank Sinatra at one particular time. She released a bunch of albums. So we mourn the...
Get me that Frenchie chick. Let's get her in here.
That's exactly
Let's
what
do one. Remember that SNL?
Let's do a little number.
Jean Moreau.
Remember that SNL sketch where
Tony Bennett, Alec Baldwin?
They did it with Jim, but they also did with Piscopo as Sinatra, and he was doing the duets albums, and it's like, get that cue ball in here, and Sinead O'Connor comes in, and they do all these duets one after another, and he's just cranking them out. It's very funny. You should look for that on YouTube.
Right, before we go, Bill, what's on demand this week?
A couple of things we've seen and one or two that we haven't. The most interesting of which is something called Colossal with Jason Sudeikis.
Nacho Vigalondo is the director from Spain.
And Anne Hathaway.
That movie got like an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
It went nowhere. It went nowhere.
It came
Nobody
and went.
It's too bizarre. It's too eccentric.
It's extremely bizarre. It's the Bigsby Bear of like a year ago. And I can't even explain what happens except that Anne Hathaway is responsible. It's become a bit of a cult film. Check it out. Let us know what you think at Sitting Around Talking Movies on Twitter. Also, The Circle, which was a big disappointment with Emily Watson and
Tom Hanks
about a special company like Google or eBay where you go to work and they take care of you. And
I hear the company supposedly, if Apple and Google made a company themselves, this is what it would be, like one of the biggest companies on the planet.
Right. A good idea that goes nowhere for me, and with some pretty big people.
What a disappointment.
But most interesting is that Tom Hanks is like now down for the count. And finally, he hasn't had a hit in like 3 movies. Finally, Going in Style, mentioned him once again, Morgan Freeman. The remake of a great film.
Who's in it?
Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, and Margaret's in it.
Yeah, and the original is so much better with
George Burns.
With George Burns.
Lee Strasberg.
Lee Strasberg.
And Lee Strasberg.
And Art Carney.
And it was Art Carney.
Art Carney.
And it was filmed at Kaufman Astoria Studios in Long Island City in Queens. If you go in there...
Three blocks from my apartment.
If you go in there, they have all the posters or a lot of the posters.
Again, now we're broadcasting in black and white again because Neil's going back to the late 50s, early 60s.
The original was real good.
It was great.
Like so many other...
What's the premise?
The premise is three old guys decide, like, the least likely suspects. Their Social Security checks are not cutting it. And, you know, when they can barely afford groceries, let alone rent.
I think one of them is dying or knows that they don't have that many. Maybe they all sort of think we don't have that many more.
They have nothing but time on their hands.
What else is it to ask for?
They have nothing but time on their hands.
They have a Betsy.
So they decide, you know what? I bet you we could rob a bank. And then it comes up as kind of like a joke. But then they say, you know, I think we could actually do this. And they wear, you know those old things, the glasses with the big nose? And
the Groucho or the...
I have a question.
They walk in with the old mustache.
Ghost in the Shell. Did anybody see that? I heard it had major backlash because of the whitewashing.
It's a piece of shell. It's not great.
It's not great. It's not Lucy, for example.
It's no Lucy, and it is no Atomic Blonde. If you have not seen Atomic Blonde yet, it's Jane Bourne.
Bill
it's
McCuddy
one of the best movies of the summer.
Atomic Blonde.
The action
Why was it
is
fourth
amazing.
On the box office list this week?
Because there was a lot of other stuff opening up. I mean, I think it had some tough competition.
All right.
Yeah, like the Emoji movie?
Well, that made a lot of dough.
It was one of the worst rated Rotten Tomatoes.
But you could bring your kids to it and park them in the theater and pay money to get
Strange Weather with Holly Hunter also up there, and two kind of interesting sounding documentaries. One is about Jeremiah Tower, the guy who is a big independent kind of chef who went away for like 10 years and made a comeback. That's produced by Anthony Bourdain, the guy from CNN, and a couple of others, including one about the guy who Jean-Paul DeGiorgia, I think, doesn't he have a line of hairdressing
or something like that?
Hairdressing.
Vidal Sassoon?
That's another guy. This guy's been on Shark Tank, and apparently he used to live on the streets the way Will Smith did in Payback.
Alejandro Gonzalez
in Happiness
also,
with a Y.
Before we go, didn't we see a documentary on Vidal Sassoon for the TV show?
I don't remember that.
I do. Yeah, it was.
Well, next time we do a podcast, I'd like to talk about the Defiant Ones. It's an HBO special.
I know, this thing keeps getting longer and longer, and I'm sorry, but I would
give us 30 seconds on the Defiant Ones.
Yeah. Defiant Ones is a 4-hour documentary, four episodes on HBO, and it's basically the success story of Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. And it's how they began in this business and it leads right into when they are bought by Apple for $3 billion.
To give you a little background, Jimmy Iovine.
Okay, 45 seconds.
He started out. It's his whole story, and he.
It's a great story.
He had no, he just started working in some, record studio, and he wound up working the controls and got taught how to do that. And he worked with John Lennon. He worked the control board for John Lennon for Walls and Bridges and. Yeah. And I think the Mind
Bruce
Games
Springsteen,
album.
Bono.
He was
Dylan,
the guy at the
right?
controls.
I mean,
from Fleetwood Mac.
For Bruce Springsteen, the Born to Run album. A fascinating story about how Bruce worked a year on the album, was obsessed on, he said 3 weeks we would just drum beats.
Let's be clear. This is not about that period of time, or it is?
It
or
is.
It's only with Dr. Dre?
No, it's back and forth because these two guys, and as Jack said, he started being the engineer for Stevie Nicks. And Tom Petty. He did the great Tom Petty album.
And the fight between Stevie Nicks and Tom Petty over the first single of Stevie Nicks'
first album.
Don't
Stop Dragging My Heart Around. Right. Yeah. And there's also a very interesting story about Patti Smith Bruce Springsteen gives her. Gives
Does he work in any of the Sound City or any of the places we've seen other documentaries?
No,
about?
I think it was like Electric Ladyland.
He was here in New York or
in
L.A.
So it jockeys back and forth between Jimmy Iovine's story and Dr. Dre's story from the beginning.
So that Straight Outta Compton, movie,
right?
It kind of tells how he began as a DJ, the Dr. Dre name, where that came from, how everybody despised the Chronic.
So this series would end just as Straight Outta Compton would start. There'd be like, this is the preamble to that, or the prequel.
It talks about Straight Outta Compton, then it goes post-forward all the way into the Apple.
So it's a good vinyl?
Yeah, it's
vinyl, but good?
It's two stories that go, like The Godfather Part 2, that go back and forth between two different stories of two people that have really nothing to do with each other.
And how they come together
to create
beats.
Come together and create beats and sell the company for
$3
billion. $3 billion, and they collaborate together. And it's really good, and it's on HBO.
I can't believe this got greenlit after vinyl. I can't believe they went down the same.
Listen, by the way, vinyl, I love the performance of Bobby Cannavale in vinyl, right?
Right.
It was excellent.
Sure, but I'm just saying, for them to go to the same category. I mean,
no,
it's different. It's different music genres, but for them to do another drama about.
No, it's
that,
a documentary.
Oh, it's completely a documentary.
It's a documentary.
Oh, so the Jimmy guy is in it. Sorry.
Yes, it's
not somebody playing the Jimmy guy.
This is a 4-hour documentary.
Bruce,
yeah.
So this sounds more like a documentary. All right.
Bruce Springsteen talks on camera.
That was my Neil Rosen impression. I had no idea what we were talking about until just a second ago.
Very funny.
All right.
All right. Well, anyway, we're way over today, but I hope you found it interesting.
To the two of you still listening.
We'll tune in next week, and we'll tell you, you know, there's no big tentpole movies opening, but there's a bunch of stuff opening, and we'll talk about it.
Some indie flicks.
And we'll have some recommendations of stuff that's on demand, and, you know.
We're going to try and get Neil to go to Dunkirk. We're going to all pitch in. There's a Kickstarter for it. If we can just...
Let's crowdfund your ticket.
Get him the $22 for IMAX, which, by the way, the last, if I can have the last word on anything, if you can see Dunkirk in anything, please see it in IMAX.
Thank you, Jack Rico, for joining us in Showbiz Cafe, but you're...
Highly irrelevant podcast.
Highly irrelevant podcast.
Which hopefully will be guests on someday.
Yes, absolutely. Would love to have you guys on.
Right. Well, that would be good.
Do we need translators?
No, not yet. It's
in
English.
For Bill Bregoli, who, as always, makes the magic happen here for us by
hey, shucks.
He's our Jimmy Iovine.
Jimmy Iovine.
Hey, and Bill McCuddy. Talking about the Will Smith movie, Pursuit of Happiness?
Uh-huh.
This, by the way, which you can't see in the podcast,
oh,
but
that luggage.
This is Pursuit of Happiness swag.
Little swag on the Bregoli side.
Is actually brought here every week, all the equipment in a Pursuit of Happiness bag.
So a little bit of Will Smith is here with us.
When he was selling the bone scanning machines?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lost his marriage because he invested all this money in these bone skating machines, which
and he used
immediately got replaced by a better machine, and now he was stuck with
it. It was brilliant at the Rubik's Cube, and that's why they hired it, and that was totally an invention of the screenwriter. The guy did.
Oh, that wasn't true of the real guy.
Has his son's career petered out?
Don't know.
You know, they were propping up his son to star in all this, the Karate Kid.
Oh, right, right.
Son and the Karate Kid remake, yeah. Or
which,
something.
By the way, was pretty good. The remake of the
was
Karate
it? And then
I liked
but
it.
Planet Earth or Destination Earth or that whole real thing. After Earth
and
yeah.
Night Shyamalan.
I think his son now just sits in a room and counts dad's money.
There
I think
you go.
That's a
for
job.
Bill McCuddy.
We watch the bad movies, so you don't have
and
to.
And for me, Neil Rosen, I want to thank you for sitting around talking movies. We'll sit around talking movies with me again next week.